So Genetec, you're basically making that transition from OEMing to Genetec as a brand.
Well, when we started, as I mentioned, our partnership with SmartSight, we had let them OEM the software, private label the software, and sell it anywhere in the world except Canada. And we kept all our OEMs out of Canada. The same thing held true with DVTEL. And when we found that we had 20% of the market, or by our estimates, about 20% of the Canadian market, but we were only getting 10% of the U.S. market, and we had only one salesperson, and they had way more salespersons, we asked them the question, how can this be? And we only got blank stares back. So we decided to do an experiment. Again, luck would have it that we... I met the brother of my wife's best friend who was in Paris, and we met at a Christmas party, and we explained what each other did, and he says, well, I can sell this. And within 8 months, he landed the Paris airport contract, and we quickly achieved a good 20% of the French market, again by our estimates. So we went back to the to our OEM partners and said, look, we think we figured this out. We know why we're not getting the same market penetration that we're getting in the United States, that we're getting in Canada, and we're getting in Europe. And it is because when the end users find out that it is an OEM, they then lose confidence and they won't give us the larger and more critical projects.
The white paper projects.
Yes. And so I had a solution. I went to DVTEL and I said, I'm ready to buy you. And they were just a sales organization. All their intellectual property that they actually originally had was tied up in this direct video television, this VDSL technology, which was
Eli, basically... Right?
Eli. Which was essentially, it was useless technology. But they still wanted to have technology company or intellectual property multiples versus sales multiples. So there's no way that we could agree on price. So I said to Ellie, that's fine, I understand that. You know, I wouldn't sell my business either, certainly not at a price you don't want. I said, okay, let's try this other thing that I will give you the exclusivity of North America as long as you sell it under the Genetec brand name. And that didn't fly either. So I said, you know, there's really not much of a choice you're leaving me. So a year after that meeting, I hired Guy Chénard, who's our global vice president of sales. And his job was to build up our sales force. So he started building it. So it took him about a year to build the sales force in the United States. So it was about 2 years after we had tried to purchase DVTEL. We then announced to them that that there was too many conflicts and we really didn't want to be selling against ourselves, and that we would terminate the OEM relationships. So although we had no contract that stipulated how long the warning should be, we effectively gave them 2 or 2.5 years of advance warning that...
Gosh, that seems like enough.
Yeah. And so we made the transition. And lo and behold, we have now picked up about another 10% of the market share in the United States, so we have about 20% of the U.S. market share. So wherever we have presence around the world, we seem to be picking up about 20% of the market. So, and we're getting airports, and we're getting mission-critical and very sensitive projects in the United States, just like we are getting around the world.
So where do you see Genetec going from here?
Well, our focus in terms of products are going to be on our three core products that we have now, which is the Omnicast video management system, the Synergis access control system, and the AutoView LPR system. In the products, what we have done is we've unified the user interface. The interface is it's a common platform that does the video, the interface for our products, and then you have personality modules that plug in depending on whether you want to do access control, video, or license plate recognition. The same is actually true for the server. So the server is, there's common parts to all of these systems. The server has, like, authentication of users is common to all of the systems. So you have a generic server in which we plug in personality modules that enable the server to be an access control server, a video server, a license plate repository. And this is all done actually using a grid architecture, and it could be actually self-configuring. So you could have a farm of computers and say these have the following characteristics, and the characteristics are such that they could be archivers, or they could be access control managers, and the system will load balance automatically those servers. So what I'm saying is, generally, in terms of the product is been architected to scale. The current specification is 2 million cameras or 2 million doors and 20 million credential holders.
Is that all?
But we can add a layer on top of that.
2 million seems like quite a few.
Well, it's interesting. I met the chief engineer of the city of Beijing, and they have 23,000 cameras that manage traffic ostensibly. And he says, how many cameras does Omnicast support? And at that time, I said, well, it was Omnicast 4. It was 50,000 cameras. And he looks at me, shakes his head, and he says, not enough. So I said, not to worry. We're coming up with Omnicast 5 soon. It's specified to 2 million cameras. And he shakes his head and says, not enough. So, in terms of our customer base, our largest customer has deployed so far 85,000 cameras out of a total 250,000 cameras. So we wanted to have an order of magnitude of headroom between what their maximum system size is and what we test to. And that's how we sort of came up with that number. I think another important point to make is that we've noticed that a lot of our competition, when you say how many widgets can you connect to the server, it's unlimited. And you will not hear that from Genetec people, because for us, unlimited means untested. So when we put a number out there, it's because we actually have tested that number, and we have test artifacts to back up our claim. And we do, even in the license plate recognition business, I was with someone at the office of the President of the United States, someone who coordinates the security agencies, and he asked me, what is the dirty secret of license plate recognition? And I answered him, I said, it's people don't publish their performance numbers, but we do. We give out our performance numbers because we know that it's not perfect. But we actually have done shootouts with all the major competition, and we do as well or better in many cases than they do, and they all are at the same. Well, the top performers, the top three performers, are pretty much are close to the same levels. We all suffer from the same machine vision problems that they all suffer from. For example, the way humans look for license plates is we look for a car, and behind the car we know that there should be a license plate. And if we don't find it there, we'll look in the window. A computer doesn't do that. A computer looks for straight edges. And and we have some special artificial algorithms that if the edges are too straight, they're probably not a plate, and if they're too crooked, they're probably not a plate.
Is that how you get past the license plate problem of different states?
No, this is how you get past the problem of reading fences, grass, palm trees, and sewer gratings.
Yes.
And
everything that's in the background.
That's right. Well, not everything that's in the background. It's straight edges, because you might, the license plate recognition problem that we've attacked is mobile license plate. So you don't have any background. Your foreground moves and your background moves. So you're trying to pick a plate out of there, and you don't have a trigger to tell you that a plate has appeared in the picture, which compounds the problem. And what you try to do, if you have a trigger that says you have a car and a plate, your performance goes way up because you know there exists a solution. There's a plate somewhere in the picture. But if you don't know, then there's lots of things that could appear to have the same characteristics as a plate, and then you'll read them. And
analyzing the target, finding the target, yeah. Then finding the license plate.
So all the systems suffer from that problem. So that's, you know, we publish numbers because they're backed by solid testing, and we know that the same laws of physics apply to all our competitors, and we're quite confident that we didn't skip any physics classes. To continue in terms of, so where we're heading is we're heading for scale and reliability. So one of Chris's objectives is to have outside third-party organizations measure and certify the reliability and the availability of the software. We already have, as I mentioned, customers who have published these numbers. And so we have pretty good numbers at 99.92% of availability over a five-year period. That's pretty good, but what we would like to do is we would like to be able to have our integration partners hit that number more consistently. So to hit that number or hit even better numbers, it's not just a question of software architecture, although that plays an important part in this scenario. It's also, there's a lot of hidden gotchas when you deploy a network, and some integrators have the technology savvy and they have all the experience so that they don't step on those landmines, and others they do step on those landmines. So we're offering services to our integrators so that we can help them design the networks, choose the equipment, and choose the other pieces of the puzzle such that they will be able to achieve those numbers. So scale and high reliability, high availability. One last thing in terms of the user interface, what we've done is we are... as I mentioned earlier, we're very, very focused on the user experience in terms of having very usable software. We do usability tests where we have the end users who've never seen the product before, and they're behind two-way mirrors and a whole bunch of cameras focused on them, and we try to gauge how discoverable is the the user interface. And so our designs are influenced very much by the seminal work of John Maeda, who is he's an MIT professor, and he wrote the book Simplicity.
Okay.
And so the architecture is a task-based architecture. And what does that mean? If you look at other softwares out there, they are basically, they have maybe tabs and you have different layouts. They're kind of a drill down. But what we do is we can create tasks that regroup the user interface widgets that you need to accomplish a given task. And if that's the only task you're going to be doing, that's going to be your entire surface of contact.
We're going to bring that closer to the user.
Yes. So the user will be doesn't have to learn a very complicated and very vast system, because our software is very feature rich, probably the most feature rich video management software out there, but. We don't want people to decide that it's complicated to use. It has to be simple to use. So by grouping grouping widgets into tasks, and users have only access to tasks for which they have been configured. The system seems very simple to them. And where we're going with this is we're going to be publishing an SDK, so our better or our more technical integration partners will actually be able to write their own tasks, or even the end users would be able to write their own tasks and plug it into the system. Now, what's also interesting is how we do the software updates is that both the client and server components are received from a centralized server. So if you create a new task, you deposit on the centralized server. The next time the user logs onto that server, they will get the updated task or components that they need. So we're taking cost out of deployment of the system. And this is of both the client software and the server software. So for the server software, the administrator will decide what personalities the servers have and what binaries to distribute to what machines. And automatically those servers, when they are given the instruction to reboot, will wake up in their new personality. And the architecture is modular such that you can take components. If you take a command and control component, you take a video indexing component, and you take a video storage component, you have an archiver. If you assign to another server just the indexing component and the storage component, you've created a backup archiver. And so you'll have this flexibility of load balancing your servers, and you'll have both the possibility of making it leaving the decision up to the software, or having a complete static configuration where it is the system administrator who decides how the software components are deployed.
So a software company like Genetec is only as good as the integrators. How do you educate the integrators in your software and how to install the software and how to work with their customer base?
Very carefully. We have it starts by the integrator selection process. When we were smaller and didn't know really what we were doing, because we were engineers, we knew nothing about distribution, we knew nothing about sales, and we made every mistake at least twice. So we had initially, you know, we were so flattered that someone would take on our product that we took on integrators, you know, just if they would
show up at the door.
They would show up at the door.
Yep.
This is no longer the case. So we choose integrators that are going to maximize the chances of having a positive end-user experience. We start by choosing them. Then we have formal training programs. They have to pass certifications, and we have a series of certification courses on the various products. They have to maintain a certain number of certifications to attain discount levels in.
So the certifications become your vetting process.
The certifications are part of the vetting process. We also have a very extensive call center. We use actually the same phone system that is used at Microsoft. It's Chris, help me out here. What's the name of it's Interactive Intelligence, the company that makes it. They're
CIP is a phone system that we're using here.
Yep,
that's a good phone system.
Yep. And so we have a relatively sophisticated implementation of the phone system, especially in the call center, where we have skill-based queues, and we actually monitor the time that people stay in the queues. If they drop off, they have options of phoning back. We're doing a lot of options to give them a good...
Extremely important, because the service, of course, after the fact is what keeps the customer.
And we're offering 724 support from our call center in Montreal. We also have a call center in Paris, but having it in Europe causes a couple of cultural problems in terms of language barriers. And so what we're doing by the end of the year is we're opening a call center in Singapore, so we're going to be able to follow the sun and have 724
all the way around globally. That's fantastic.
So, and then we offer services to our integration partners, such as commissioning services, such as project management services. So some of these very complicated deployments, such as airports, we actually have to have an internal project manager coordinate the contact with our integrators. When you have 10 or 20 people from the integrator that all are phoning into different parts of Genetec, that could just cause confusion. So we funnel that through a project manager, and then he project manages it inside of Genetec. So we offer those services to our integration partners, because when they succeed, we succeed.
So with the convergence, using one of the buzzwords, the convergence of security and IT, who do you find embracing an IP-based system such as Genetec?
Oh, well, I think that about last year people have decided that IP was the way to go. And I think that there's no longer any question in anybody's mind that the analog doesn't give the same results. Just in the same way that although you still might have a cassette deck in your car, I doubt very much you listen to anything but CDs, and even that, it's being quickly phased out by personal digital storage devices.
I was telling my daughter the other day that my her iPod's quite a bit smaller than the 8-track player that I used to...
Yeah, I had one too.
All right.
So I don't think that there is any question that in everybody's mind, they understand now the benefits of IP. IP gives a couple of things. First of all, we've almost shaken loose of the NTSC and PAL low pass filter. That was a limitation on the resolution and quality of the video that we could view. And now with entirely digital systems, we can start going to HD and even beyond those resolutions. Then also with IP, you can start applying well-learned techniques that our banking system has perfected over the past 30 years of storage management and scale management and availability. And so you're able to do things that were not possible in the analog world. It's estimated that in analog systems, up to 40% of the recordings never happen. Certainly, this is what happened in the London bombings. 40% of the video that they tried to recover was unreadable. Now, these were both analog and standalone digital recorders, but they did not have any centralized health monitoring, no way of centrally ascertaining if the hard disk died or if the tape was just... had no oxide left on it.
Or if the transmission was even going through.
That's right. And so with applying IT techniques, we just get a better quality of service. And the second or third benefit that you have is that you can now start to share this video. So the video, even though the cameras might initially be installed for security purposes, they typically are used for operational efficiency, for marketing, for emergency management, and other telepresence applications. And by sharing through various departments, you can spread the cost out, and you can also you just increase the performance of the organization.
So interoperability becomes much more realized by the customer than they ever could before with analog.
Yes. Well, actually, analog interoperated pretty well because you had some very simple electrical standards to connect between your camera and your recorder. But there were things that you couldn't do. For example, We have a utility. It's a gas company, and they have two emergency control centers, one on either side of the St. Lawrence River. And in an analog system, they would have had to string an analog fiber between those two, and the expense would have been enormous. With a digital system, they lease a pipe that is big enough to handle their worst-case traffic, and they can be anywhere. We have a customer that has two emergency management centers in North America and one in offshore, and this is not a problem.
What's the most interesting project that Genetec has problems or service that you've provided throughout the time that you've been in existence? It could be your favorite or the most interesting. We have some of those, and I'm sure they're different, but pick one of those.
Every project comes with very interesting problems and interesting situations. So one interesting fact is that the official residences of five of the seven G7 leaders are protected by Omnicast. And so some of the Genetec engineers have actually penetrated into the personal homes of the top seven leaders, or five of the top seven leaders of the world. So these are fun situations. We have projects that deal with very complex networks that are frustrating at the beginning, but are very satisfying once we've tackled them. The Canadian air traffic control system is a case in point, where they have 12 control centers spread over 10 million square kilometers. And from any control center, they can manage the video and actually do some facilities management through that. The network varies enormously. So some places they have very low bandwidth links. Others they have they just have massive amounts of bandwidth, and you have to deal with those networks in a uniform fashion, and so that project was very challenging, and it still is, because actually our biggest challenging projects, what we have is we have an extensive test procedure. We have 28 test strategy documents, and those test strategy documents are on top of about 3,000 test cases. And so our complicated customers, such as NAV Canada, has its own test strategy. And so we execute that strategy. So testing is a very expensive part of our development cycle.
But it also sets you apart.
It sets us apart because a lot of people just tend to say that their spec sheet is unlimited. We can put unlimited number of workstations on a server. And what we do is we put numbers on everything, because for us, unlimited means untested, and we do extensive testing. For example, the throughput of our archive server is the published number is double that of the of our nearest competition, but the real number is actually five times higher than that of the competition. And these were certified by two independent organizations, one in Europe and one in North America.
What would you say to a young person coming out of college, either in engineering, IT, or looking just in general at the security industry? What would you say to those folks as they come out and look at the world as a career move?
I have the opportunity to address university students on a regular basis. The first thing is I encourage them to do as well as they can in math, because mathematics is the language in which nature has been written. So being good in math is going to be a good barometer of their future success. In Montreal, there is a lot of cinema, electronic cinema that's done, and a lot of electronic gaming. And there are specialized programs in digital arts, and I am often called upon to give them a little address to remind them that there are other venues other than video games and digital cinema. If they want to do video, serious video engineering. Also, when I talk to integration partners and sometimes in speeches and conference, I'm asked by integrators, you know, how do we deal with this digital world? And I encourage them to actually use internships. And to hire the young people who know nothing about security, and but are they know about the technology, and couple them up with a veteran who knows everything about security and little about technology, and these are a winning combination. We have a very big tradition in Genetech. When we were inside. Marconi. Well, we're a very value-based organization, and our five values are our employees, our customers, ethical conduct of business, technology. I'm an engineer, so technology has to be there somewhere, and society. And we do give back to society. You know, we have some works that we're very proud of. Some stuff that we've built a hospital in Africa. We have some scholarships that we give out to science students. But what we are the most proud of is our internship program. And it started in a very very strange way. It was when I was at Marconi, my boss had left for a three-week vacation to China to adopt a Chinese girl. And so I get a phone call on Monday morning by the vice president of surface transportation, Mr. Peter Gasser, who I had mentioned earlier. And he phones me and he says, come to my office. I come to his office and he says, okay, you have two interns that are starting next week. I want you to think about what you're going to do. And I look at him and I said, don't you know the old software adage that adding more programmers to a late software project will make it later? And he looked me in the eye and he said, it is your social responsibility to prepare the next generation of engineers. Hmm. So I happened to be taking a leadership class at McGill that semester, so my term paper was decided then. My term paper would be mentorships in object-oriented development, and I got my two interns, and it turned out to be wonderful. I didn't give them the classic customer support job. I gave them something challenging, and one of those two interns turns out to be Matthew Bro, who is our user experience architect, and he's still with us today. So he received check 001 of Genetech and check 999 by some coincidence. And that experience was so positive that the next semester, no questions asked, I hired more. And in the second semester, we got Jonathan Doyon, who is our chief of technology today. And Chris didn't come through the internship program, but you came through the internship program. David Chauvin came through the internship program, and I believe it was around 2001 that we received a commendation from the Sherbrooke University of producing very high quality internships, and we have a reputation. You come to Genetech and you come to learn. And they also, our reputation is that engineering tourists need not apply. So,